Again, good morning or afternoon, everyone, and welcome to emforum.org. I am Amy Sebring and will serve as your host and moderator today, and we are very glad you could join us. For any first-timers, we will be providing some instructions so you can relax and participate with us. We do want you to take part in this discussion. Now, if you need any assistance, please select the Help Desk from the drop-down options in the Q&A panel, and our associate, Lori Weber, will try to assist you. Today's group discussion asks the question, are your emergency operations plans realistic? This relates to not only the planning assumptions about hazards, public reactions, et cetera, that underlie these documents, but also assumptions about the capabilities and resources that can actually be brought to bear in a large disaster. As mentioned in our announcement, this program was inspired by a couple of articles recently posted by today's guests. We will have a few opening remarks from our guests, but then we will dive into our discussion. We have posted 10 discussion questions to stimulate the conversation, and hopefully you've had a chance to look them over. For each question, we will be displaying a polling tool that you can use to participate, and you should find that fairly straightforward. There'll be a panel that will open up for you to check responses. And although you will be able to see them, I will be reading out the full questions and summarizing the responses for the benefit of those who will be listening to the audio-only version of the recording in the future. But in addition to the polling tool, we do ask you to submit comments on the topic at hand or any questions you may have for our guests by using the Q&A panel. And to ask a question or make a comment, then you just please select host from the drop-down menu in the Q&A panel and then type in the area underneath. I'm going to close the chat panel at this point just to kind of clean up some of the clutter here and make it a little easier to find the other panels. All right. While you are responding to the polls and composing your input, our guests will have a few words on each subject. As usual, today's recordings will be available from our site later this afternoon, and a transcript will be available early next week. Now, it is my pleasure to introduce today's guest, author, blogger, and emergency management consultant, Lucin Canton. Lou has extensive emergency management experience, including being a certified EMAP assessor. So in the course of his assignments, he has had the opportunity to review many emergency operation plans and continues to find erroneous assumptions in them. Please note that Lou publishes a free monthly newsletter, which you can subscribe to from his website, and you can find further biographical details and links to the articles and also to his newsletter page on our background page. Welcome back, Lou. Thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today. Now turn the floor over to you just to get us started, please.
Great. Thanks, Amy. Well, it's really a pleasure to be here, and I'm really kind of excited about this new format we're trying because a lot of times when we do these things, I'm kind of standing here talking to myself and, you know, the words going out and don't really get a whole lot of feedback from folks. So this is, I think, a really interesting way of trying to get you to sort of direct the comments that I'm going to be making. So, well, it's kind of what gets me going on this. I guess that's the first question. Over the years, as many of you who've been reading my material know, I've really felt that focusing on strictly on the emergency operations plan is not what we really do as emergency managers, that we have a larger scope on that. So obviously, emergency planning is something I focus on quite a bit and trying to figure out what's the best role for us in. As I've looked at plans over the years, one of the things that keeps striking me is that the plans are written to meet standards or written to meet grant requirements, but they don't really seem like plans that would work realistically. And a lot of times as an assessor or somebody that's evaluating plans, maybe as part of the National Plan Review or even as a consultant, nobody really asked me to comment whether I think the plan will work. All they ever asked me to comment on is whether or not it meets a particular standard. So I think it may be time for us to sort of rethink how we got to where we are, how we do planning, and maybe look at making some changes. There are three main trends that I think have brought us to where we are today. The first is, I think we've seen an increasing role of the federal government in disaster relief. And by the federal government, that also, of course, translates down to the state. If we go back to the earliest legislation dealing with disaster relief back in 1790, we see that there was an emphasis on individual responsibility, that the person that suffered the disaster really had to bear the consequences, and that in rare occasions the state would step in and do something. For example, the first legislation in 1790 was a relief of excise taxes. So very little role of the government in early days. And as we look through history, what continues to happen is the edge of the envelope gets pushed a little bit. You have the fires in Alexandria, Virginia, where Congress for the first time appropriates money. And then you have a lot of discussion as we get into the late 1800s about the appropriate role of government. And it's interesting to study the history and look back and notice that there are a lot of folks in Congress and a lot of folks across the country that were pushing back against the idea of federal disaster relief. So the upshot, though, is that we've seen this over the years increasingly more and more emphasis on the role of government in disaster relief and less of the individual in disaster relief, to the point where I think we've gotten now from the point of view where it's no longer a person's responsibility, it has become to a certain extent a government entitlement. Along with that, I think has come a change in how we view disasters. And by that, it's in the early days, there's a sort of an acceptance that if you perform risky behavior, that there will be consequences and that there will be inevitably in any disaster some casualties. And we've sort of changed that attitude now to one from where we used to, as emergency responders, look at doing the most good for the most people, to changing that to look at something a little more along the lines of no casualties are acceptable at all. Now, that's not necessarily a bad thing, and I you know, it's one of the things I think that makes us in the United States very different from a lot of other countries. But at the same time, it does add a layer of complexity to our planning, and it does change the way we view people. And we've come to this part of this disaster mythology of looking and saying, well, clearly because it's government's role to take care of everybody, people are not necessarily responsible for their own welfare, and we can't necessarily count on them to do things well in disaster. I think that's kind of an inherent underlying theme in a lot of our plans. The second trend that I think has gone along with that is if you are, in fact, putting the role of disaster responder, disaster relief provider on the government, and then you need some sort of way of fulfilling that responsibility. And so concurrent with that emphasis on government responsibility, we've seen the rise of what, for want of a better term, we call the disaster bureaucracy. And we've seen the emergence of government agencies that are responsible for disaster planning. We've seen it at the state level, at the local level. And we've developed this whole mechanism, again, of imposing how the government can structure planning and response and relief after disasters. On the other hand, we sometimes forget that came from a very specific type of planning that we had to do, and that was Cold War planning. Initially, the role of the government really was about Cold War planning, and the people that were brought in to do these plans were military planners. And military planning follows a very, very set format, and it's essentially contingency planning. So from that, we've sort of evolved into these plans now where we try to anticipate every possible occurrence. We come up with these checklists. And again, I think Lee Clark really speaks to it well, is that what we're doing is really kind of convincing ourselves that we really can control something that we probably can't control. And so we end up with these very, very structured plans that, again, meet standards but don't necessarily talk to the particular resources of the jurisdiction. I think one of the things that we've done with it – now, don't get me wrong. I firmly support standardization. I think having standards and saying, you know, these are the minimum things you need to meet, I think make an awful lot of sense, and I think it's a good way to sort of move things in the right direction. But on the other hand, the one-size-fits-all type of planning that we're doing right now, I think, again, takes away from two things. One is that each jurisdiction has very unique hazards and a unique set of hazards, and a unique set of resources, so you have to take that into account. And the second is that we also are kind of getting away from what the research shows us, that when people respond to disasters, it's creativity, it's improvisation, it's doing things other than the way you expect it. These are the things that we look at successful operations, and this is what happens. All of us that have experienced disasters know it never goes the way you expected it to go. You kind of change your mind at the last minute. You do things the way you've never done them before. You get creative. You get ideas from other people. So we change how we do things based on the disaster. And so I think by building these rigid plans, we're not necessarily training our people to respond well using that level of creativity. The third fun thing that I think is important is now that we've dumped this responsibility on government, we've created a bureaucracy to deal with it, now we turn around and we cut the funding to it. And that, I think, is probably the single biggest thing we're all dealing with is we now have a responsibility to do these very complex plans. And you know, when you start looking at the things that we've added over the years, concerns about functional needs, concerns about populations that are maybe less advantaged than some of the others in our community, looking at different community organizations, what we're finding is that it's a very complex plan, and we don't have the resources to do the planning. And so when we come back and we start talking about setting planning resources, sooner or later we get caught up in this, yes, but you have to plan for this because it's a grant requirement. One of the things that really frustrates me as a consultant is a lot of times when I'm called into a jurisdiction and we start talking about their emergency operations plan, it's never, can you help us do a plan that works? It's always, can you help us do a plan that meets the requirement? I'll give you a classic example. I was working with a very small jurisdiction, and it's interesting. They have the standard plan, you know, the three-inch binder with all the annexes and all the checklists, and they had NIMS and ICS. It was a perfect plan. And then I asked them how many people actually worked in their government. And this is the entire jurisdiction. They had 26 government employees. So clearly, you know, that plan was not realistic for them. And when you start asking questions of people, well, how do you actually deal with crisis on a day-to-day basis, you'll find it's very, very different from what's written in the emergency operations plan. So that sort of kind of brings you to where I am now. I have to admit that a lot of the ideas that I've been thinking about the last few weeks are very, very formative. I still don't know. You know, there's obviously a lot of good stuff that we've done over the years, and I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. But on the other hand, I think it may be time for us to start looking at some other options and considering how do we take what we've done well, how do we now turn that into something that we can actually reasonably expect to do at the local level in terms of the funding and the staffing that we have available. And maybe that involves some prioritization of certain tasks. Yeah, we'd like to be able to do them, but these are the things we have to do as a core. And maybe then a larger jurisdiction has a greater responsibility because they have more resources. And certainly larger jurisdictions have very unique needs that they have to plan for as well. And then we get into the whole area of regional planning. So my eyes are still very formative about that. And that's one of the reasons I'm very excited about the seminar today is to kind of get some of your feedback on this and whether you think I'm totally off base. So look forward to your questions. I'm going to turn it back to Amy, and we can get started on our list of questions.
Very good. Thank you, Lou. That's a good segue into our first couple of poll questions. These obviously are closely related, so we've grouped the first two together. And please note, on these first few questions, you can select more than one answer. So, question number one is, for local communities, whose priorities should drive planning? We have local, regional, state, or federal as the options. And then the related question number two, for local communities, whose priorities actually drive planning? Again, the same options, local, regional, state, federal. And while folks are responding to that, Lou, did you have specific comments on those questions?
Yeah, well, like many of the questions that we get, there aren't really easy answers because, obviously, from my perspective, local priorities are your starting point. Clearly, I think one of the problems we have with the one-size-fits-all plan is that we are really trying to impose something where we're not really considering the fact that local jurisdictions have different needs and different risks and different resources and different cultural attitudes. You know, there are some jurisdictions where what we would consider a disaster is just this is what happens every year. I'm fond of talking about a community in Guam that gets hit by just about every hurricane that comes through Guam, and they just learn to live with it, and they don't want to move because this is where their home is. So while local priorities drive it, I also think that you really have to start thinking these days about regional planning as well. And the reason for that, and we'll talk about this a little later with resources, is that you just don't have the resources anymore in any single jurisdiction to deal with crisis. And we are stretched to deal with day-to-day emergencies. And so we really, reaching out to our counterparts for mutual aid, reaching out to the state when things get really bad, this is, I think, a very good system that we've evolved in the United States. And so I think that we certainly want to retain, but the priorities have to be, first of all, local, but then looking at the rest of the bigger picture.
Very good. And just a couple of seconds, we will get these poll results up. I have to wait for it to time out. Okay. And I hit apply. All right. Hopefully you can see the results now on the screen. And, of course, the overwhelming response to question one is local community. We have 39. I'm not going to give all the numbers. I think you can see them on the screen. And but interestingly, we have, yes, this is reflected in your remarks about who's actually driving our priorities at this point.
Yeah, I think the thing that's interesting.
Federal.
I think the thing that's interesting about this topic, Amy, and in general, is when I talk to my colleagues one-on-one, there's total agreement. The people that are actually doing these, they're not happy with the plans they're doing either. And I think that's the point is that if we started listening more to some of the people that are actually out there in the field, and a little less of just people looking at things from the perspective, it really looks good on paper. You know, it looks very logical. It makes a lot of sense. But you've got to leaven that with, you know, but yeah, this is how it really works down at the local level. You know, we don't get 14 different people in multiple groups for emergencies functions. What we really have is one representative from the Park and Recs Department who does 400 different things. So.
And we do have one comment already. And, folks, again, I do remind you, please, if you have comments on each of these questions as we go along, that's what makes it a discussion. So please participate in that way as well. And this is from Gary Sickett. Please always forgive me for butchering last names. He says, we focus on symptoms versus consequences, and that results in assumed capacities versus actual capabilities reflected in plans. Most plans fail to address beyond the response what are the elements of reentry, recovery, restoration, and the resumption of operations.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think one of the things that we have this idea of fantasy plans, and one of the articles I did, of course, is on fantasy documents, which comes from Eric Ofter Heide's book on disaster coordination. But we make assumptions about our capabilities because no politician wants to stand up in front of his jurisdiction and say we're not ready. So we give this impression that we have all these resources. We give this impression that, you know, we have all these capabilities, but the reality is something somewhat different. And we really don't base our plans on what we actually have. We sometimes we tend to believe our own press. Now, on the other hand, we have done well over the years. You know, one of the things that I'm proud to be an emergency manager in the United States is because we do respond very well. We do, but a lot of times it's because people that know what they're doing, people that are well-intentioned, get it done by improvising. It isn't necessarily because they've done this major plan beforehand. I think it's because they've built the relationships, because they understand their business, and there's that mutual trust among different agencies.
We have another comment from Timothy Riker, who says, given that we must meet federal and state planning requirements, what do you suggest we do to ensure a practical plan that can be implemented?
Yeah, that's the rub. If I had an answer for that, I'd probably be making a lot more money. I'm still evolving ideas. I mean, obviously, the first easy one to say is, well, let's change the way the feds look at business. And any of us that have worked with the federal government know that's not as easy as it sounds. I think you have to strike a balance. Clearly, you know, there are requirements out there that you have to meet. The question becomes, what are the things that have to be real? And, you know, one of the things that I look at when I start talking to jurisdictions is, how often does your team meet? You know, how often do you even run through tabletops? I mean, I'm not even so concerned about functionals and full scales because they cost money, but you can do tabletops very simply. So what I'm looking for normally is, are people building the relationships they need? Who are involved in your discussions? You know, are there community groups involved in it? Or is it just, I remember one organization came down and they changed emergency directors, and they threw out everybody that was meeting at their monthly meeting and brought in just police, fire, and emergency medical. So it's sort of a little bit incestuous. I mean, sure, yeah, those are the big response agencies, but the whole idea of then, you know, transitioning to recovery, of dealing with community issues, of dealing with people with functional needs, all that kind of went out the window. And they rapidly reversed that about 6 or 7 months later when they got a new emergency director. So yeah, I think really you have to work on two fronts. The first is, you know, meeting whatever criteria you have with the least amount of effort you can put into it, but making sure that anything you actually put out can, in fact, be done realistically. I think we have to push back a little bit. And the other side of it is, I think we have advocates in people like Craig Fugate, and I think we communicate with them. I have a great deal of respect for Craig, and I have a great deal of respect for the things he's been trying to do with FEMA, but he needs help. You know, he can't do it all by himself. And I think the more we at the local level make our opinions known through our elected officials or directly in support of some of the initiatives, I think that's the only way we can really approach this.
Very good. I do have another quick question. I do want to move on to some of our other poll questions, but Stephen Spieth asks, how are you defining the term regional? Does it incorporate multiple communities or counties or states?
Yeah, I kind of think locally, and again, because I've been a local emergency manager. I've been at both the federal and the local level, but not at the state. And I kind of look at, there are communities that are in close proximity to each other that draw on resources from each other on a day-to-day basis. So I think that's your first starting point. If we start talking about catastrophic planning, that changes a little bit, and I think you have to look at a larger region. But from a regional perspective, I think in terms of those folks that are used to working with each other and responding to each other, and maybe one community can't afford all the resources, but as a group you can afford, for example, a bomb detection team or a hazmat team or something like that. But I've also seen regional where it works at the county level. There are some very small jurisdictions in California where a lot of the response capability that we would think of that a local jurisdiction would have actually comes out of the county. Law enforcement is provided by the sheriff. Fire is provided by county fire. So in that case, it becomes that. I think that county becomes the region. So I don't think it's a hard and fast definition. I think you have to look at who are your partners and how much do you rely on those outside partners.
And I want to get Ava Jean had a question in here. You already touched on it, so I think your answer is yes. She says, is it possible that the number of emergency managers in local jurisdictions can use their clout to drive change in planning?
Yeah, yes and no. As a group, emergency managers don't have a lot of political clout, and particularly if you look in a jurisdiction, there's only one of us. But I think one of the things that we're seeing more and more, and at the end, if we have time, I'll talk about what I think are some of the positive things that are going on, but we have a lot of community groups that are starting to get interested in what we do, and I think you can then start leveraging those and their political clout. You have homeowners and associations that are working with some of the counties. You have the CERTs, who form a small group as well. So one of the problems is we really don't have a good political constituency. But I think the more we can unite, the International Association of Emergency Managers does an awful lot of educating of our legislators. So I think participating in groups like that, building your local constituency, getting people on your side, and stop looking at it as it's just us against them, but rather, you know, we're representing the community, and these are what the community is saying, not just us.
Right. Okay. We will move on to our next poll question, which goes to the hazard-specific plans versus the all-hazards approach that you mentioned. I'm going to go ahead and open this poll. The question is, which hazards should local communities plan to respond to? And we have the options, those that have historically occurred, unlikely threats, future climate trends, all hazards approach. There's probably others, but Lou, any comment?
Yeah, this is always one because you pick the wrong one and it happens, you know.
Right.
I like to tell people, first of all, you have to look historically. You know, if it's happened before, it's going to happen again. It may be happening something different, but I largely believe, with very, very few exceptions, there's nothing new under the sun. Sometimes people say, well, this has never happened before, and I go back and, but in 1715, that happened in this town, you know. So you can play that game. But I think the real issue here is to discuss what do we mean by all hazards. I think, unfortunately, what we're seeing more and more is the attempt to say, you have to identify every potential hazard and you have to work out a plan for how you're going to deal with that. And so we have these very specific hazards, specific appendices and annexes. And I think we have to go back and say, wait a minute, all hazards mean I have to be able to deal with anything that comes along the pike, you know, within a certain range of level of disasters. It doesn't necessarily mean I have to plan for every single possible disaster. We need to think not so much in terms of agent-generated needs, but in response-generated needs of, you know, can we do sheltering? You know, what are the conditions under which we would do sheltering? What if we didn't have our shelter sites? What would be our options? You know, so you think in terms of depth. You also think where you start talking about contingency plans, where you have specific identifiable hazard. If you've got an inundation zone in your community, you really need to plan for that because you can. You know, you know where the water's going. You can do some very detailed planning, and that becomes a contingency plan. But, you know, to say, well, it's possible that an asteroid could strike my hometown, therefore I'm going to have an asteroid strike annex, that might be something you want to put down towards the bottom of the planning list. I think, and it's also worth saying that, you know, plans are something that I think we should be looking at in terms of continuous improvement. I like to say that an emergency plan is really nothing more than a snapshot of your thinking at that particular point in time, and that your planning continues to evolve. And so if you've got time to do more and more contingency planning, that's great. But I think a lot of times we're trying to do too many things at once instead of focusing and saying, first I'm going to fix this and I'm going to fix that. And I think we have to do the same with hazards. We have to prioritize. We've gotten away from this idea of risk assessment, of looking at the risk and saying, yeah, that's a possibility, but right now this one's a bigger possibility. I need to focus on that. And really to get away from planning for specific hazards unless you're actually doing contingency planning, but rather looking and saying, consequence-wise, what am I dealing with here? You know, I know power is going to go out. Now, the question I have to do as part of my risk analysis is how long is the maximum I can expect to be without power, and what would be the consequences of that? So I think that's the way of looking at this is rather than focusing specifically on the incident, use that to look at the impacts and say, yeah, I've got a capability to deal with that, or I need a capability to deal with that.
Okay, so we do have the largest percentage of our poll respondents selecting the all-hazards approach, and then following that is those that have historically occurred. And I do have a comment on this, again from Gary, and he says the occurrence of extreme events cannot be predicted from a review of past history. Worst-case events, when they happen, exceed the worst-case at the time. The worst past event had to be a surprise as it had no precedent, and it's a selection bias.
Yeah, and I think Gary's point is well taken, is that, you know, one of the risks that we run into is where we say, well, because it happened in the past, it's going to happen exactly that way, and it doesn't. It's always going to be different. But I think, you know, if you are in an area where you know there's been hurricanes, you need to plan for hurricanes. Here in California, we plan for earthquakes. But what none of us planned for was one day we got a call at, there's a funnel cloud forming over the airport. I had no idea what a funnel cloud was. I didn't realize we got tornadoes in California. So, you know, you have to kind of keep your eye open and say, well, so our question became, well, so how would we respond to a tornado all of a sudden, something we'd never thought about? And we started breaking it down in terms of what would be the functional need. Well, we'd have damage. We need to do search and rescue. We need to cordon off, all of which were skills that we had available. And so I think that's the point of all hazards planning is you take the incident, you break it down into its component parts and look at the needs that you're going to that it's going to generate, and you say, okay, I have that capacity or I don't have that capacity. You know, here we estimate, I think it's 30,000 people in San Francisco that are going to need sheltering after an earthquake. Do we have that number of shelter beds as at least a minimum to get started? And the other thing we sometimes don't look at is timing on response. You know, there are certain things you need to provide right away. Certain things it'll be uncomfortable, but you can live without for a few days. And so we sometimes think of providing everything all at once rather than saying, we only have the resources to move certain things. Let's move these things first. Classic example, they sent us out for an operation in Kwajalein. And we, of course, put all the important people on the first aircraft. We got there. We couldn't work because we didn't put any of the dumb stuff, you know, like paper on the aircraft with us, you know, printers, computers, you know. It was one of those, yeah, we sent the wrong things out here.
Well, that's, again, a good segue to our next poll question. Let me go ahead and open this one. And also, we have a comment that is just on this topic, which is we're asking about the so-called core capabilities required for the all-hazards approach. So the question is, what are the essential response capabilities for all-hazards response planning? And some of the options are continuity of operations, warning, evacuation, communications, resource management, other.
Yeah. You know, again, this is one of those areas that I hesitate to sit down and say it's got to be all these things or exclude these. I think, you know, for years we've had some things we've identified as core functions of the emergency management program, which I think are pretty standard and pretty reasonable. I think really, though, the things that I don't see on it and the areas that I emphasize when I start talking to people about their planning is this idea of how do I gather information? How do I even know there's a disaster going on? And how do I translate that into information that people can use to make decisions? I think if we start, you know, we look at all these other things, but ultimately it comes down to two things: assessing what you're dealing with and applying resources to that particular problem. And those are two areas that we don't always do terribly well. I mean, we've been wrestling with this idea of situation awareness for years now. We also know that, again, from research, that jurisdictions don't do well when they're suddenly overwhelmed with an influx of resources. I mean, Quarantelli talked about that back in the 50s, that, you know, the big problem with disasters isn't that you have no resources. It's usually that you're overwhelmed with resources coming in from the federal government or the state government or from outlying communities or from volunteers, and you don't know how to ramp up. You know, as jurisdictions, we're basically bureaucracies, which is not a bad word, and bureaucracies are very slow to react to things, not very nimble. And so part of the problem we have, so while we look at these things, and I think all of these are important, I think we also need to think in terms of how do I recognize the disaster is happening and how do I move, you know, from my day-to-day operation to this disaster operation? And secondly, how do I make decisions based on that information that will then translate into resources being applied towards the problem?
All right. We were going to look at our results here in just a moment. We've got a couple seconds to – all right. And we have the poll results displayed, and pretty much all of them are selected.
Well, yeah, and I think that's completely right because, I mean, if you look at some of these things, I mean, our first concern is always public safety. You know, so the core things of warning to the public, getting them to evacuate if they need to evacuate, providing some sort of sheltering, you know, everybody would agree are core functions. The ability to keep your government operating, continuity of operations is a key thing. Yeah, because it doesn't do you any good if you respond well if you have nothing left to start reconstruction, start rebuilding. Communications, obviously, you can't do any of this without communications, and communications at all levels. So I think, you know, the list that we've developed over the years, I think is still a very reasonable list. I think the question becomes, as we start tacking on the variations to this, how do we prioritize that in terms of planning for a local government? You know, in other words, what is the absolute core that I can be expected to do at a SAMA jurisdiction of 20,000 people? And how does that vary from a jurisdiction that might have several million people? You know, there obviously is a difference not only in quantity but in quality. So, you know, if my jurisdiction is small enough, my sheltering plan might be we evacuate everybody to jurisdiction B because they've got hotels and they've got a school that we can use, and we don't have that. So I think we have to get a little more creative, and instead of just saying you have to have a sheltering plan, to take that a little step further and say, well, yeah, but what does that really mean to my jurisdiction? And you know, again, the issue of if I'm going to evacuate and I have one police officer that is, you know, maybe assigned to the other side of the county. And actually, that's true. We have a couple of counties here in California that are so rural that at night you get one sheriff's deputy who for the entire county. So if you start talking about doing an evacuation in any of those jurisdictions, it's a little difficult. So, yeah, so I think that's part of all these things I think are important. I think the question becomes how do we prioritize and really how do these things look differently in different jurisdictions?
I've got a couple comments, and again, folks, we're happy to hear your opinions or questions. Frederick, I'm sure he put this in at an earlier point. Frederick Frey says, I think that's why emergency management functions are important to plan for, and that's the list basically we were just looking at. And we have from Gary, focusing on tactical without involving private sector leads to false positives and unrealistic expectations. And we're going to get more into that question in terms of involving the public as well. So.
Yeah. And again, this is one of those things where I think, you know, when we start talking about the whole community concept, we're on the right track. I think we're not going to be able to do this without the public. But the question becomes is, that also adds some planning complexity. That also adds a time commitment for your planners. And so how do you go about involving the public? How do you make that link? And we'll talk about that a little bit later on, I think.
Yeah. All right, we'll go on to our next poll questions. Again, we got two grouped together here. And, you know, obviously no jurisdiction, or I don't know of any local jurisdiction, that, you know, in a major disaster has all the resources that is necessary. And that's kind of a fundamental assumption. So assuming you need more resources than you are able to provide, or even the assumptions about your own resources, the question five is, where will supplemental response resources come from? And we have mutual aid, state resources, federal resources, non-governmental organizations, and other. And, you know, this is per your plan. And then question six follows up with, but in a widespread disaster, will these resources actually be immediately available to your community? And the options there are yes, no, or don't know.
Well, again, I think this gets back to this issue of what is it, who is your jurisdiction, and what are we talking about here, and what sort of event are we talking about? I think sometimes we didn't. One of the commenters made the point earlier that we tend to look at the past and say, well, this is what we're going to need because this is what we did, and we don't really project out our needs. You know, we don't necessarily have studies in particular communities that show what we might need. And so the question becomes, well, what resources do we really need? And I think one of the things that I think we do really do very well here in the United States is the ability to apply resources, to move them from one jurisdiction to another. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to be there immediately, but within a matter of days, you're going to have the resources you need. So the question becomes is, what do you need immediately, and how do you provide that? And again, we've raised these expectations that we do things very well. So we see things like people expect that the shelters are going to be open immediately. They expect they're going to be fed immediately. They expect every need that they have is going to be taken care of immediately. And even though we talk about the 3 days, which, by the way, nobody seems to know where that came from. We made that up. the simple fact is, we've created this expectation, so if we don't meet it, then we failed, whereas I kind of push back at that and say, well, wait a minute now. You know, we provided the things that we had to provide immediately, and usually that ends up being something around the idea of water. You know, you can go without food for several days. You can go without shelter for several days, depending on your weather conditions. So you have to look at what are the resources I need right now, and that may change depending on the circumstances of the disaster. The disaster right now in California that put us out on the streets, you know, sheltering is not a big issue. It's beautiful weather out here. It's a little cold, but, you know, it's sun shining. If you're back east and you're up to your elbows in snow, it changes the dynamic. So, again, I think when we start talking about resources and response resources, we need to get specific to the jurisdiction. We need to let jurisdiction priorities drive that. Not so much saying, well, these are all the things we have to provide, but say, realistically, this is what I'm going to need in the first 24, 48 hours. These are the things that can come later. And then we start looking at where we're going to get those. The other thing that I think we forget, too, is that we rely very much on mutual aid. Certainly out here in California we do. And we assume mutual aid will be there. That isn't necessarily true if you're dealing with a widespread disaster or a catastrophe. And so what do we do then? Classic example, Y2K came around, and we were planning for a wild evening here in San Francisco, and we called up our mutual aid partner and said, so about all those resources you normally send us, we'd like to kind of double up a little bit on those. And they said, what are you talking about, kid? it's Y2K. We're keeping everybody home. We don't know what's going on here either. And so we were in a position where if we needed them, we could ask for them and we'd probably get them, but we couldn't have them deployed the way we normally did, which was going to have an impact on us. So, again, we assume that things will be there and they won't necessarily be there. And so we have to be able to, again, this idea of flexibility and improvisation in disasters, we have to be able to switch gears and say, well, where do I get this?
And also thinking of the situation where, you know, obviously if you're a small community, that's your community is your priority, whereas in a widespread disaster, the state and federal priorities may be somewhere entirely different from you.
Yeah, an excellent point, too, is that we all see it from our perspective. We had a case in California during Loma Prieta where the emergency folks, the people that were responding to the disaster out in Watsonville, turned on their TVs and they saw San Francisco burning. And, of course, they immediately thought back to 1906 and the whole city's in flames. Obviously, all the resources are going to California or to San Francisco. Therefore, we're not even going to make any requests. Well, it turned out that, it was one block in San Francisco that was burning, and it was pretty serious, but, it was the fire department dealt with it. The people that had the worst damage in the Loma Prieta earthquake were, in fact, in Watsonville. So we tend to, we see what we see. We don't necessarily see the big picture. And nobody likes to be told you're low on the priority list, but that, in fact, may be the case.
Okay, we're displaying our results and, of course, the additional answer to question five. Basically, all of those have been selected, mutual aid, state, federal. Mutual aid seems to be slightly in the lead, but on the follow-up question, will those resources be available? We, in a large disaster, we have a majority saying no, probably not. So.
Yeah, and that's, again, no big surprise because, the initial stages of any operation is you're trying to figure out what happened.
Right.
My chief of staff used to come into an exercise. She'd get all excited, like, everything's chaos. You guys say you don't know what you're doing. I'm like, yeah, you're right. It is chaos the first few hours because we really don't know what we're doing. We don't know what has happened. We don't know what the impacts are. We don't know who's been deployed. That's why we have a system. This is why we're working through it. Give us a half hour to an hour, and we will have an accurate picture of what we're dealing with. And that's the same thing that would happen to any of these. The people that would provide you with mutual aid are occupied with trying to figure out what the impact was on them, so they're not willing to release that mutual aid until they're sure. And you yourself are going through this idea of trying to assess, what exactly is happening? Is this a disaster? Is this not a disaster? Will I need resources? Will I not need resources? So, when we start talking about things immediately available, it's really there's a time lag that goes on, and people don't really grasp that sometimes. The same with pacing and EOC operations. A lot of people, because of our exercises, we don't get a lot of time, we don't get a lot of money, so we compress exercises. So a functional exercise, people are just moving lickety-split through the exercise, and then you get to an actual event, and you're sitting around drinking coffee and waiting for the phone to ring, depending on the nature of the event. So it's really this idea of let's look at what our needs are here, and let's think about this. And that's why I think it's so important that the folks at the EOC isolate themselves from the actual response in the sense that don't let that be your only focus, but try to look at that bigger picture. Look at the information that's coming in. Look at the things that other people are missing because they're focusing on the actual response.
I have a comment from Jay Vogel, and I think it pertains to the previous questions when we were asking about capabilities. And he remarks that it depends on what agency you're planning for. As a utility emergency planner, our priority is continued utility service, and other assistance must come from similarly trained personnel, i.e. mutual aid.
Yeah.
And when it comes to the priorities that we've seen in Sandy demonstrated so vividly, we all know why power is such a high priority, because without that, a lot of our other stuff doesn't run. So.
Mm-hmm. Actually, we can learn a lot from the private sector, and from agencies like because. But again, one of the interesting things from Sandy, and I think I may have blogged on this a while back, is perceptions. The perception is that those bums, they didn't get the power back on. When you go and you look at the statistics, and they actually got the power up to, the measurement I believe is like 80% of the population. They got 80% back in the fastest time that it's ever occurred. And so, you know, obviously when you've got major devastation, you're not going to get the power back because there's nothing there to energize. But they're pretty good. You know, the people that deal with the power, they actually move very quickly. And while they're, you know, we're so used to having power that if we're without it for a few hours, we think it's the end of the world. But the fact is, I've seen minor events in other countries where it was a month before the power came back. And these we're talking about just heavy snowfall. And people didn't bother them. You know, it happens. You have other countries where the power comes on for just a few hours each day. So I think our folks do an amazing job, and it's because they have a very specific function. I think that's the other side of the coin. You know, as emergency managers, we really have a very broad scope that we have to deal with. And there are so many things we've got to do. And at the same time we're trying to orchestrate response, we're also thinking about recovery and what are our next steps. And so I think that's what makes the job so challenging, is that of all the people involved in the disaster, it's our job to look at that big picture and to avoid being drawn into just the response, because we know that's just the prelude. You know, the real issue is coming as we go back into continuity, as we go back into recovery, as we go back into reconstruction, and we know we're in it for the long. We are just getting ready to, I think, is it this year or not? Yeah, this year. We're just getting ready to reopen the Bay Bridge, the new extension that was damaged in Loma Prieta in 1989. So, I mean, recovery goes on forever.
Okay, I think we're going to get through the rest of these fairly on schedule here. Our next question relates to assumptions about how your public will respond. Do you expect them to merely follow your instructions? So the question is, do your plans assume the public will do what you expect? The answer is, options are yes, no, or don't know.
Yeah, this kind of gets to the core, I think, of when we start talking about realistic planning. An awful lot of folks that I talk to out in the field have not bothered to look at some of the research about how the public will actually act in disasters. You know, back in the 50s, we started studying disasters. Essentially, it was part of the Cold War. The idea was, if we use disaster as an analog for nuclear attack, does that tell us something about how people will react in a crisis? And, of course, from there, it now has become a study in its own of how do we look at disasters, how do people react. And we find that we make assumptions about how people are going to react, and we tend to look at anything that deviates from that assumption either as a bad thing or as, you know, something that is somehow aberrant. And some of the assumptions, we assume that people need to be led, you know, that we need a strong central authority. We assume that people may given the opportunity, will loot and pillage and do all sorts of bad things. We assume that people have to be taken care of, that we have to provide everything for them. And what we're finding is, I mean, the research very clearly shows, back from the early days, that's not true. People tend to react altruistically in disasters. They tend to help each other. They tend to focus on their own recovery. And so the question, I think, and this is, to me, the real crux of my thinking over the last few weeks, has been, how do I channel that? Because clearly, as government, I have an interest in making sure that the big picture is being taken care of, and I can't just throw up my hands and say, well, it's a personal responsibility and you guys can handle it. How do I interface with what's going on out there already? You know, and I haven't really thought through this a whole lot yet, but I'm kind of coming to the idea maybe it's in the provision of resources. You know, we can't get as granular as going door to door to distribute something that somebody needs. It's very difficult for us as government. But we can do points of distribution that community agencies can go to draw those things that then go out to their neighborhoods and distribute things, for example. Maybe the congregate feeding facilities that we've traditionally used in the past isn't necessarily the best way to deal with things. Maybe local feeding might be more appropriate through churches or through community groups. So, you know, I think this is something that is still wide open. I think I'm seeing a lot of things come out of Sandy where social media is becoming the glue that is tying all these things together. They're allowing people to identify needs and match them up against resources. And so I think the real question for us as government planners is, how do we translate that community spirit? How do we interface with that? How do we emphasize it, how do we keep it going? And how do we, what's our part in this role? And I think part of that, too, is as we start talking about social media, is that we have to sort of accept that we are not necessarily leading that option, that operation again. And, you know, we're so used to being the lead, but when we start talking about some of these things, we're a facilitator, we're a participant, but we may not be the lead. And that's a hard thing for a lot of us to accept.
I have a couple of comments on this one from Stephen Spees. He says, their reaction depends in large part on their sense of community, available resources, and prior training.
I'm sorry, can you run that one by me again?
I'm sorry. You should be able to see it up there now. The reaction, the public reaction depends in large part on their sense of community, available resources, and prior training, or maybe means prior experience.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that, and that again, kind of gets to it, is how do we, and that's part of the whole community concept, how do we reach out to the community now? There are things that are going to emerge. And you know, for example, after the riots in London, we saw people organizing their community cleanups by themselves. The government had no hand in it. They set up Facebook sites. They set up websites. They set dates for people to come in. They found the resources they needed. So they're taking responsibility for their own community. And so the question, when people start doing that sort of thing, how do we interface? So that's going to be one issue. But the other issue is the more we can bring people together as a community ahead of time, the more we can find out who the community leaders are and involve them in our planning, obviously the better we're going to be. The question I have, and again, I don't really have an answer for this yet, is how do I do that? You know, when I've got limited planning resources and I've got this whole list of things I have to plan for just with my public agencies, how do I bring the community in on that, and how do I do that kind of planning when I don't have the resources to do the planning I'm supposed to do? And so I think that's going to be the discussion over the next few years, and I think it's going to be an interesting one.
A question from Gary says, how do you overcome media-driven perceptions regarding panic, chaos, and fear? In other words, the media as a group, or some are better than others, I'm sure, may have, you know, all these false assumptions that we've been talking about.
Oh, yeah.
And spread them.
That's kind of the holy grail, because I know we have been wrestling that from heck, you know, back with the first newspaper. I don't have an easy answer. I think there are a couple of things that make perfect sense for us. The first is we need to look at crisis management, crisis communications much better than we do. You know, we tend to think our public information folks are really about putting out information to the public, and instead of looking at this from a crisis management perspective, saying, how do I communicate my story quickly to the media? We also need to work at getting rid of a lot of these mythologies ourselves, you know, to talk with people ahead of time, to do, you know, conferences. You obviously want to have a good working relationship with the media in your jurisdiction, but the problem comes, you get a big event like this, you get national media, and they're looking for the big story, and, you know, it's very hard to work with them. So I think part of the issue is you really got to beef up your public information side of things. You've got to be proactive. You've got to look at some of the things we talk about in crisis communication, of getting the story out. And, you know, we've got a kind of a tool for it now with Facebook and some of the others. It's really hard day-to-day for government to use social media because, let's face it, the stuff we're putting on our Facebook, nobody wants to read. It's boring as sin. But at the time of crisis, people may, in fact, get into it if they view it as a trusted source, and we can quickly dispel rumors through that. So I think social media is, again, another part of the game change that's going on now in terms of dealing with the community. The other thing is finding out who are the folks that people will listen to in communities and involving them. So there is no easy answer to that one because I don't think we'll ever actually be able to do it, but I think we can certainly do a better job of countering rumor and countering bad impressions. And, you know, if you can provide information to the media, it's easier for them to do the story than for them to go out and look for it themselves.
Very true. All right. Well, I think we can squeeze in our last few questions in the time remaining. Opening the next poll question, which is, are your drills and exercises based on accurate assumptions and reflect the contents of your plan? The options there are yes, no, don't know. And you alluded to this before, Lou, about how important it is, even just to do tabletop.
Yeah, I think each of the types of exercises out there have very specific functions for them and the reasons why you do them. And so each of them, you know, they have an appropriate place in your pantheon of exercise, your exercise plan. However, what I have found over the years is the most bang for the buck is a tabletop. You know, you can talk through issues, you can get people's opinions. Our monthly meeting in San Francisco, we would always do a 20-minute tabletop on some topical issue. Sometimes it occurred that morning, and we just and it was very simple. Here's what's happened. Suppose it was worse. What would be our top three priorities? You know, or who would be responsible for this, and what supporting resources would they need? So you can just essentially you're just conditioning people to work together as a team. So I think that's part of it, and they're very inexpensive, and so they're a good way to go. And then when you're ready for your functional, you'll need funding, you'll need planning time, you'll need a lot of resources, and then you know clearly you're going to need to do that at some point, but. Lots of multiple tabletops, very quickly, very short tabletops. You can really cover a lot of ground. But the big thing that I think there are two things I think people don't do well in exercise. First is to actually sit down and figure out what the objectives they're trying to test in the exercise. You know, what is it we're trying to find out here? And so you need to really clearly define that objective up front. Now, I'm not big on the H-heap where you've got all the different capabilities you've got to test in, and of course, ATEEP is maybe going away because the target capabilities list is going away. It's going to get interesting to see what happens next. But ultimately, you need to know why you're doing the exercise and what you expect to accomplish from it. The second thing that people don't do well is make the scenario realistic. You know, I see so many exercises where the inject is a citizen calls the EOC and reports this. Well, you know, will in fact the citizen call the EOC? Do they have their number? And if you get that call, are you really going to deal with it at the EOC, or are you just going to pass it on to the dispatch? You know, so look at things realistically. How would you know this? And what is it you're going? And then build your scenario based on cues and the actual information that you can expect to get in the EOC.
Lou, is there any possibility you can stay over about 5 minutes?
Sure. I'm good.
Oh, that'd be great because I've got a lot of comments here, and we've got a few more to work through. Let me get some of these out. We have Ray Pena says reactions. I think he's talking the public reactions here. Reactions to crisis are shaped by role relationships, spouses to each other, parents to their children, workers to coworkers. Individuals will consider their obligations to others when deciding what course of action to take in an emergency.
Exactly. I couldn't agree more.
Nice point.
I think part of the problem is that we don't understand that. We don't factor that into our planning. Different cultural groups will react differently in disasters. You need to understand the culture of your community and how people view disaster. There's some cultures where it's we sit down and wait to be helped. And there are others where, you know, we take care of our own. You don't need to do this. There's some people that are incredibly afraid of certain types of events, but not others. I say the folks in Guam, didn't matter. Hurricane coming, we're used to that. We can handle that. Earthquake in Southern California, a lot of the Latino community had experience with the Mexico City earthquake, so they were not interested in going back in their homes. Even if we said it was safe, even if we'd done inspection, they were not interested until they were sure there were no more aftershocks. So, again, cultural differences are key. And that also influences what will happen with your staff, whether people will come back to work or whether they'll leave work and so forth. So, yeah, absolutely. It's shaped by people's culture.
I also have a comment on the media question from Jim Murray, who says, I think the media can be managed by using a proactive approach. We speak of it but do not do it well.
You're right, because for years we used to talk about the media like they were the enemy. And we trained our emergency man. We talked about chumming the water to keep the sharks at bay. We refer to them as wolves. And again, I think you have to distinguish. It's not monolithic. I think that we sometimes make that assumption that the media are all the same, and they're not. You have local media generally because they're part of the community. They have a vested interest in working with you, and you can build some pretty good relationships with them. I find the broadcast media are a lot easier to work with than the print media because a lot of times I find the print media has already decided what the story is when they call me for the quote.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm a little leery of print media. I like working with broadcast media because you can always say, let me shoot that again. I've always found the people that I work with really looking to get my side of the story, honestly. I've never – only once I felt like I was getting a little bit of an ambush. However, again, when you start getting national media, they have no local connections. They really don't care. They're there about the story. They're there about the ratings. And so they're a little bit difficult to deal with. But again, yeah, I think he's absolutely right. We talk a lot about dealing with the media, but we really don't train our people in crisis communications. We train them in public information. We train them in public relations. But we don't necessarily train them in crisis communications.
On our poll results on the drills and exercise question, the majority of respondents said yes, they do. But I do have a comment from Gary who says, we create happy face exercises that do not focus on failure points, find where the plan will fail. It is more difficult than one thinks.
Absolutely. Yeah, you get a lot of political push. You know, I've had, and in the military, I had guys say, you know, if you tell me that we fail on this, my career is over. And it's like, well, sorry, you did, you know. So, yeah, there's this political pressure. People always want to feel good after exercises. I always like to try to strike a balance. I feel that you should have people coming out sweating after the exercise saying, phew, boy, I just pulled that out by the skin of the teeth. We need to go back and look at our plans. I don't believe you should have an exercise where everything goes well. You know, to me, I try not to do that, but I do realize that there are sometimes political pressures. But, yeah, you're right. We do a lot of feel-good exercises. I'm not a big believer, just me personally, on full-scale exercises simply because they tend to become just that. They're showboats for the media. And, you know, I think you're better off holding drills, holding functionals. And like I said, I love tabletops. But I think sometimes when you get the full-scale, it takes on a life of its own, you know, and it's very difficult to get to those failure points. I have crafted exercises deliberately, though, to stress parts of systems. We had a plan in San Francisco when I first took over that had certain things that people were very invested in, and my colleagues and I looked at it and said, this isn't going to work. You know, we inherited this plan, but this isn't going to work. So we crafted an exercise that showed that it wouldn't work, and then people were able to come back to us, and it was their idea then saying, we need to change the plan, rather than the new kids on the block saying, you need to change your plan.
Rich Van Dame asks, can you elaborate, and we don't have time to elaborate too far, but he says, can you elaborate on the impact of standards on this aspect of emergency incident management?
Yeah, I'm a big believer in standards. I think the question becomes, what do you mean by a standard? I think there are standards that, like NFPA 1600, that give a general direction, you know, where you can say, you need to consider these things, but you don't necessarily have to have all of them in your plan. So I think those sort of standards that give you the flexibility and give you a direction, I think, are worth doing and worth having. I think where you get standards that are mandating, you must do this, you must do that, I'm a little leery of those just because they tend to take away then from the jurisdiction's ability to craft their plan based on their own individual needs. But, yeah, I think part of our problem with planning is we're not research-based, so we're not looking at what things really go on in disasters, and we're not standards-based in a lot of cases where we're looking not so much at what the flavor of the month is, you know, the current CPG is, but we're looking long-term saying, as a community, these are the things we should have.
All right, let's move to our last couple of poll questions. The next one is, we know we're supposed to update our plans following major events when, you know, to incorporate lessons learned. But this poll question asks, are your plans actually reviewed and updated following a major event to reflect your experience and those lessons learned? And the options there are yes, no, don't know.
Maybe so. Well, I think this actually gets back to something that's related to exercises as well, and that's this idea of a creative action or a corrective action plan.
Mm-hmm.
For years, we've done exercises, and we've come away, and we've done a little report at the end and said, these are the problems we found, and then we never go anywhere with that. One of the things that I like in NFPA 1600 and a lot of the standards we're seeing now is that we're pushing this idea. It's not important, you know, it's not so much important what you're putting into it, but the idea is you've got to track whatever you've decided is a problem. And so corrective action plan talks about here's what we identified, here's what we're going to do about it, here's who's going to do it, here's the timeline, here's the resources, and you then review that at your monthly or quarterly or whatever, wherever your oversight group meets, you actually look at that and say what's happening with it. Now, there's a vetting process that has to take place because I used to get comments after exercises of things like, we really need a place to hang our raincoats. And like, yeah, sorry, that's, you know, from my perspective, that's not a corrective action I'm going to track. But then the question becomes, do you actually then turn around and change the plan? And I think, yeah, you know, it's expensive, it's time-consuming. How far do you go and when do you make your change? You know, we talk about reviewing a plan every year. We talk about changing it every couple of years. And it's very difficult to do. So, you know, I think the concept is good. The corrective action is good. Maybe one of the things we need to be looking at is how do we actually physically present our plans. And with a lot of the electronic systems that are out there today, it's fairly easy to have a plan that people can access very quickly and you can make changes to, and you don't have to go back and do the old, you know, here's the 15 pages, take out page 5 and put in the new page 5, take out page 30 and put in a new page 30A, 30B, 30C.
Right.
You know, we can get away from that, I think.
Okay, our poll results, the majority selected yes, the plans are actually updated.
Okay. Oh, good.
And let me move on to our final question, since we are running over, and we'll open that up. And this question relates to whether perhaps we need external reality checks on our plans from time to time. So the question is, to what extent should the whole community be engaged in the planning process? Options there are not at all, be public review and comment, advisory group, other. What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, I think if you've got people from the community involved in the planning process to begin with, that sort of becomes a moot point because they're already involved. I think the way a lot of us are structured, there is an opportunity for community involvement, and certainly our meetings are open to the public. It's also interesting to see a lot of jurisdictions will post their emergency plan, a lot of jurisdictions won't, you know, citing security. So I think it's something a member of the community should have access to. I mean, it's a community plan. But I think, you know, whether you want to formalize that, I think, again, that's something a community can decide. I mean, there's some communities where I think it would make sense to have it available for people to comment and get their comment. I think it depends on what exactly are you talking about. You know, if I'm doing planning, I'm integrating, for example, functional needs in my plan, I really want the functional needs community involved in that process. I want them vetting my plan before I go final on it. I want their comments. I want their input. Same if I'm dealing with, you know, for example, feeding. You know, I may reach out to a number of non-public sector agencies and ask people that might be involved in that, for example, Salvation Army, and I want their comments. So I think it's something I think each jurisdiction can decide for itself, but I certainly feel you do need to have that community input. I mean, it's their plan ultimately.
Okay. Well, we have run over. Lou, we're very, very grateful that you could actually hang with us a little bit longer. And on behalf of Ava Jean, myself, and all our participants today, we do thank you very much for joining us and giving us some good food for thought. And we look forward to seeing more of your postings in the future.
Great. Well, thanks very much. It's been a pleasure being with you.
Great. Folks, before you go, please do take a moment to do give us a little feedback on our feedback form here and any additional comments you may have. And we are pleased to welcome a new partner today, who is Dr. Thomas D. Phelan, principal with Dr. Tom Phelan Consulting, formerly Strategic Teaching Associates. Please see our partners list for a link to his organization as well as our other partners. Our next program is scheduled for February 27th, when our topic will be a public preparedness campaign, quote, Who Depends on You? And our guest will be Mary Schoenfeld, Public Education Coordinator for the City of Everett, Washington. Please make plans to join us then. Have a great afternoon, everyone. We are adjourned.